Greetings once again, America. You may have heard the news, but stand by now for the Worldview. That's right, it's the weekly Worldview, back to a worldwide audience on the World Wide Web. My name's Doug McBurney, and I'm so glad to be here with you this week as we welcome back our global audience to the Worldview. As you know, the show did take a brief hiatus. I believe the last show we did was somewhere back in the summer of 2004, I think. We've been reviewing the archives to figure out exactly when it was we went off the air. It's been a little over 4 years, but the show never really ended. I've continued to do the show on almost a nightly basis, but to an audience of just one, my wife. And she's had a great time, and she's been suggesting I bring it back. And, well, once in a while, the kids listen. We have our daughter, Nicole. She's 7. We have our other daughter, Zoe. She's 2. And we've got one on the way. One coming at the end of April. We have not yet decided on a name, but I digress. Let's get right to it. This is The Worldview. This is the show where we don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do take the news of the week and focus it through the lens of original thought. And we'll start. I was looking for the story that would open the premiere broadcast here at theweeklyworldview.com, and I did not really find one that I thought was an appropriate open. So if this seems a bit inappropriate, please forgive me, bear with me. Remember, I'm shaking off the rust from my 4-year hiatus. But let's dive right into the news of the week. Dateline Merrillville, Illinois. A pastor in Merrillville was shot and killed during his Sunday sermon this past week. A tragedy. No, not a tragedy. A tragedy is where someone has a car accident or gets a disease. This was a horrific crime. There in Merrillville. The pastor was shot and killed during his Sunday sermon, and apparently the gunman fired 4 rounds at the pastor, and the pastor deflected the first of the gunman's 4 rounds with his Bible, sending a confetti-like spray of paper into the air. Now, I've considered preaching the gospel. I don't consider myself qualified at this particular time in my career, but I've considered preaching the gospel, and I suppose if I did preach the gospel, that if I were to die, the way I would want to die would be preaching the gospel. But I would prefer that it was a massive coronary or some kind of massive brain aneurysm or something that just, boom, took me out right there. I would prefer not to be shot in the pulpit. But the Bible is a thick book. In fact, my pastor likes to say that the Bible's thickness is proportionate to the thickness of the skulls of the people that the book was written for. So the Bible's a thick book. So let me read from the story. The gunman strode down the aisle of the First Baptist Church shortly after 8 a.m. and briefly spoke with Reverend Fred Winters, then pulled out a .45 caliber semi-automatic pistol and began firing until it jammed, whence churchgoers wrestled the gunman to the ground as the killer waved a knife, slashing himself and 2 other people. Now, if it is the case that the first bullet was indeed deflected by the Bible, it also suggests to me that had there been someone in that church who was packing some heat, why, the pastor may have ended up with a fairly interesting story to tell, and he may have left the church that day with his life. Because at our church, I can guess or I can posit the idea that had someone fired a bullet at our pastor and he'd been able to deflect that first bullet with his Bible, by golly, that shooter would have been, well, he would have been full of lead before he would have ever cleared a second shot. And so, by the way, the shooter's name was Terry Sedlacek, and when the police found his day planner, there was a reference in the day planner that he had singled out Sunday as Death Day. He's a 27-year-old man, And how does the story end here? Oh, the pastor, unfortunately, has gone on to meet the Lord. But the killer, what does it say here? The killer was charged Monday, with first-degree murder and aggravated. So the killer survived. And that's just sad. I would have hoped that someone at that church would have been carrying a gun. I'll tell you, I'm going to get to a story a little bit later about the collapse of evangelicalism. Not evangelism, but evangelicalism. And we're going to talk a little bit about how standing and preaching the Word of God puts one in direct contrast to the culture, to the government. And it may convince more than one of you out there that the time has come in our churches to be prepared for attack. Now, we've always been prepared for attack on a spiritual level, and we've always been ready to do battle on a spiritual level. And the church I attend, Denver Bible Church, here in beautiful Denver, Colorado, does a great job of that. But ladies and gentlemen, we need to be prepared to do battle on a physical level, it seems. These church shootings seem to happen more and more. And this is just another fine example of how, number one, it's important to be prepared to meet the Lord, because it could happen at any time for any one of us. So we always need to be prepared. And I certainly hope and I expect that the Reverend Fred Winters there in Maryville, Indiana, was indeed prepared to meet the Lord and is right now enjoying paradise. I certainly hope so. But had the killing been prevented, and had the killer himself been killed by a vigilant and armed, by folks vigilant and armed there in the church, why, he would have had a great story to tell, and it would have been a great object lesson for the youth of America. But unfortunately, things didn't turn out that way. Now let's move on. I've got several stories here on our new government. Now, when the Weekly Worldview sadly went on hiatus back in the summer of 2004, the Republic was in the hands of the feckless and rather inept George W. Bush, a Republican of the highest order. And now, well, you would have thought it couldn't have gotten worse, but it has gotten worse. It's as if the Marxists have taken over from the socialists, and now we're in real trouble. And the decision this week by I just can't say it. Hold on, I need a drink. President Barack Obama, his decision this week to undo George Bush's rather schizophrenic decision on stem cell research is exposing religious divides. That's a story we're going to cover here from the Associated Press from this past week. The embryonic stem cell research debate is steeped, according to Eric Gorski, the AP religion writer. The debate is steeped with religious arguments, with some faith traditions convinced that research amounts to killing innocent life, others citing moral imperative to alleviate suffering, and plenty of religious believers caught somewhere in between. And let me tell you what, folks, we've got plenty of religious believers out there who are caught somewhere in between. And what that means is they don't know what they believe. Because if you don't realize that an embryo is indeed a human person, well, then you can hardly call yourself religious, at least in the true Christian sense of the word. And I believe Obama, can I just call him Obama and not President Obama? Because if I have to say President Obama in the context of reality, I just have a tendency to freeze up, okay? It makes it very difficult for the show to continue. So I think I'm going to call him, well, I'll tell you what, folks, if you're here and you can help me out, please help me think of a term that I can use for our pseudo-messianic president, Barack Hussein Obama. I'll just call him Obama for right now. Now, I want to talk about our side. And by our side, I mean Christian. I'm a Christian. I'm a right-wing Christian. I've even been called a fundamentalist Christian, especially when I was being hauled off to jail for standing up for the truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ and the rights of the innocent and most defenseless in our society. But Reverend Susan Brooks, did I get that right? Reverend Susan at Thistlethwaite, a United Church of Christ minister, and she is a professor at the Chicago Theological Seminary. She says, quote, "There is an ethical imperative to relieve suffering and promote healing. This is a good policy," referring to Obama's policy, to use the broken bodies of the tiniest human beings for research purposes. She says, "This is a good policy for a religiously pluralistic society that cares about human suffering and the relief of human suffering." Now, folks, when I read that statement coming from an Episcopal reverend, I felt like I had fallen headlong into a George Orwell novel or something like that. It's just creepy and scary, and it should make your skin crawl. Now, the AP story goes on to say that Obama alluded to religion in announcing the changes to the policy, saying, quote, this is quoting Obama, "As a person of faith, should I try to do an Obama impression? I haven't really worked on one. I haven't worked on an Obama impression. As a person of faith, I believe we are all called to care for each other and work to ease human suffering. I believe we have..." No, I just can't do it. I can't do it because I don't have a teleprompter. I need a teleprompter if I'm going to do a Barack Obama impersonation. I will try to work on it this week and bring it back next week if Obama's still in the news, and we can hope that he's not. But so you folks, your assignment this week is to figure out a term I can use to refer to Obama, and I will try to work on my Barack Obama impersonation. Anyway, back to what he said. "As a person of faith, I believe we are called to care for each other and work to ease human suffering. I believe we have been given the capacity and will to pursue this research and the humanity and conscience to do so responsibly." Is that right, Obama? He thinks that we have... Oh, well, of course we've been given the capacity. We've been given the capacity and the will to do just about anything we choose to do. But to pursue this research under the guise of alleviating human suffering is, again, it's simply Orwellian. It's newspeak. It's just bizarre, and it scares me. I mean, it really, really scares me. Now, they go on in the story to talk about more liberal religious traditions. And the AP tells us that... more liberal traditions, including mainline Protestant and Jewish institutions, believe the promise to relieve suffering is paramount. In 2004, the governing body of the Episcopal Church said it would favor embryonic stem cell research as long as it used embryos that otherwise would have been destroyed, and that embryos were not created for research purposes, and if embryos were not being bought or sold. Now, for the Episcopals to state that it would be okay if we only used embryos that, quote, otherwise would have been destroyed, isn't that taking predestination a little bit too far? To say that these embryos would have otherwise been destroyed is to imply that the people involved in the creation of these embryos had no choice other than to destroy them. And the fact is, if one undertakes the creation of embryos, which is a serious matter, it's not as if you're shackled and you have no way out except to destroy the embryos. There are a number of options out there, ladies and gentlemen. These embryos are not destined for destruction. It's just that the people who created the embryos have decided to destroy them, and then a ghoulish researcher comes in and feels as if he's absolved of any responsibility because, well, they were destined for destruction. Well, excuse me, Mr. Ghoulish Researcher, but you Once you get your grubby little paws on the embryos, you could decide that they're not destined for destruction. In fact, you could keep them in the freezer, and you could put them up for adoption, and they could end up growing up little boys and little girls, healthy, happy. They could be introduced to other people. They could get to know God and the entire creation, and they could live out a wonderful life if they could just make it through your ghoulish, grubby little fingers, Mr. Freak-like Orwellian researcher. And the idea, the Episcopals with their idea that embryos won't be bought and sold. Excuse me. Right now, the entire Planned Parenthood racket is licking their chops, and they're just waiting to buy and sell these embryos that you so callously cast off as predestined for destruction. It's just disturbing, ladies and gentlemen. Now listen to this. Under Jewish law, this is according to the Associated Press, so my Jewish friends out there, I don't want to imply that this is what you believe, but I'm just going to tell you what the Associated Press says. Under Jewish law, an embryo is genetic material that does not have the status of a person. According to the Talmud, the embryo is simply water during the first 40 days of gestation, and that healing and preserving human life takes precedence over all the other commandments in Judaism. Now, first of all, this idea from the Talmud that the embryo is simply water during the first 40 days of gestation tells me that whoever wrote the Talmud didn't read the Bible, for crying out loud. And to assert that somehow magically during the first 40 days of gestation, an embryo gains a soul it just borders on the ridiculous if one has any idea of science whatsoever. And I'm not going to say that the guys who wrote the Talmud were scientists in any respect. In fact, they probably weren't. I'm sure they weren't privy to the scientific knowledge that we have now regarding embryology and the development of the child in the womb. But to suggest that the embryo is simply water during the first 40 days of gestation suggests to me that there were a number of our Hebrew brethren in church leadership at the time of the writing of the Talmud who were pretty much okay with abortion and killing a child if it was simply inconvenient. Let's face it, folks, it goes all the way back. It spans all different cultures. This is not an idea that is specific to the Jews, certainly not. In fact, I would think that my Jewish brothers and sisters are far more pro-life than your typical Episcopal anyways. But anyway, I digress. Let's finish this story. This is making me upset. The very first story of any serious import that I'm doing here at the Worldview, and my blood pressure has already shot up. Now, the Reverend Joel Hunter, who's an evangelical pastor from Orlando, Florida, he serves on Obama's White House advisory panel on killing innocent people. Wait a minute. That doesn't actually say that. There, hand me that pen over there. I need to see. I add my own comments here, and I don't want to credit the AP with that. But the Obama White House advisory on the killing of innocent people and the harvesting of their organs and cells. There's a reverend on the panel, if you can believe it or not. And when I get to, now, this really explains the story I'm going to get to later on the coming collapse of evangelicalism. What does the Right Reverend Joel Hunter have to say? He says, quote, "The principle is still that it's not only understandable, but in some ways moral, to use embryonic stem cells that are destined for destruction, for research, for helping people." There's that predestination thing again. It's as if we can't control it. It's as if once someone decides that, well, this embryo is destined for destruction, it's as if a history has been written and we simply can't stop it. He says that it's moral. He says it's moral, ladies and gentlemen, to use embryonic stem cells that are destined for destruction. He says, quote, "Now remember, this guy is on Obama's White House advisory panel on the killing of innocent children and harvesting their organs for profit." I made that up. I mean, I made up the... He does have a White House advisory panel, but I made up the rest because it was very appropriate. He says, now this is the Right Reverend Joel Hunter. He says, "I think we have to tread very lightly and very carefully. And I think we have to be vigilant for years to come." And I just want to say to the Right Reverend Joel Hunter, Reverend, no matter how lightly you tread, God will hear you. It's the Weekly Worldview. I'm your host, Doug McBurney, and nice job with the bumpers. I have a very, very attractive audio engineer here next to me. She gets me a little bit distracted sometimes, but I will continue forward. I've got three quick stories to do out of the Far East, okay? Because I've been hearing talk all week, and I just want to clarify this for people. The story out of Bloomberg this past week about China's premier, Wen Jiabao. He says he's concerned about the safety of U.S. government debt. China, by the way, is the U.S. government's largest creditor, and they're asking the U.S. to, quote, maintain its good credit to honor its promises and guarantee the safety of China's assets. And folks, China holds plenty of debt here in the United States, but all week I've been hearing talk about why is Wen Jiabao, why is he saying this? It's not as if China can suddenly cash in all this debt and just walk away. I mean, they're committed, ladies and gentlemen. They hold $696 billion of U.S. government securities. So why is Wen Jiabao suddenly interested in making sure that we understand, that they understand, that we should understand that they hold a lot of our debt and that that means a lot there? Is this a credible suggestion that they're going to take their business elsewhere? It just struck me as odd. And then I saw this story. From earlier in the week, a potential conflict is brewing in the South China Sea. Obama has dispatched heavily armed American destroyers to the scene there in the South China Sea, the scene of a naval standoff between U.S. and China. On a day that Mr. Obama and his senior officials met with Chinese Foreign Minister Yang Jiechi, in Washington, Beijing showed no signs of backing down. Apparently, a Chinese ship bumped into an American ship, and there was some bumping and grinding going on out there, and the Chinese Navy was, they were being a little bit belligerent. But worry not, ladies and gentlemen, Obama is on the case. Mr. Obama has urged more military dialogue with China to avoid similar incidents, the White House said. I always hate that line in stories because it's as if the White House is talking. And really, it's Obama said. And Obama said it, and I suppose he speaks for the White House. Anyway, that's just an aside that really is meaningless. I don't know where I'm going with that. Like I say, folks, I'm shaking off a little rust, okay? I've been on hiatus for 4 years. Cut me some slack. All right. The president also stressed here, according to... I'm not sure where I got this story. I believe this was a Reuters wire. The president also stressed the importance of raising the level and frequency of military-to-military dialogue. And folks, with Obama in there, we might just get that. We might get plenty of military-to-military dialogue with China. And now, the key to the riddle, ladies and gentlemen. Why is China bringing up the fact that they're worried about holding all this U.S. debt? Why are their warships bumping and grinding with ours in the South China Sea? Well, let me tie it all together for you. Japan, dateline March 13th, Tokyo. Japan has threatened to shoot down a satellite that North Korea plans to launch early next month if it shows any signs of striking Japanese territory. Tokyo's warning that it would deploy its multi-billion-dollar missile defense system raised tensions in the region after North Korea said that it had identified a potential danger area near Japanese territory along the rocket's flight path. The North Korean regime told the International Maritime Organization that the missile would be launched during daylight between the 4th and the 8th of April, and that its boosters would fall into the Sea of Japan, about 75 miles from Japan's northwest coast, and also into the Pacific Ocean. Now, folks in Tokyo are freaking out, okay? Because I'll tell you why. The North Korean missiles are notoriously less than accurate. Let's just put it that way. And if they plan to drop a booster 75 miles off the coast of Japan, there are people sitting in their apartment complexes in Japan wondering if a booster isn't going to land in their kitchen. Now, for us here in the United States, this is all an interesting academic discussion, but if you're living in Northwest Japan, it's a little bit more serious than that. Now, officials in Tokyo, according to the story, said they reserve the right to destroy any threatening object in mid-flight, despite North Korea's warning that it would consider such a move an act of war. And here we have it, ladies and gentlemen. Why are the Chinese suddenly becoming belligerent about holding our debt? Why are their Navy ships trying their best to intimidate our fine naval warriors out there in the South China Sea? And it's simple. Because North Korea is finally going to be challenged. Because the folks in Japan are not going to allow North Korea to shoot any type of tapo dong, hit you anywhere, miss where we don't want to go, missile, over the cities or even the coastline of Japan. So this could come to a head. And what's interesting, let's see here. Let me try to... All right. The North Koreans say that they're trying to put up a satellite, and the Japanese are basically saying, we don't care what you're thinking about doing, you maniac. If you launch this thing, we're going to shoot it down. And listen to this, folks. Japan and the United States, according to the article, have jointly developed a ballistic missile defense system that includes interceptor missiles aboard ships and Patriot missiles dotted around Tokyo. So here we are, folks. This is where the rubber meets the road. We've heard about missile defense. There's been all kinds of talk about missile defense. And now if the Koreans decide to launch this satellite, we are going to find out about missile defense. We are going to see missile defense live and in action. And I can tell you this, the North Koreans, their leader, what is his name? Kim Dong-il? Kim Dong-il doesn't care. He's half in the bag all the time. He's just a maniac. He's a lunatic. But the Chinese government, ladies and gentlemen, is not interested in finding out if the joint U.S.-Japanese missile defense works. And they seem unable or unwilling to deter the North Korean maniac from going ahead and launching this missile. They seem unable or undeterred. They seem like they're going to let it happen. And the last thing they want is to find out that indeed Japan, along with the United States, does have credible missile defense. And the last thing I want to see is a booster fall into somebody's kitchen in northwestern Japan. But one thing I certainly would like to see is a North Korean missile shot down in mid-flight. That would be really, really cool. That would be a source for celebration. All right. Now, speaking of celebration, I want to move back from the Pacific Rim, back here to domestic issues. Justice Ruth Bader... see, I can't say that either. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Ruth Bader Ginsburg told a law students that there could be an opening on the Supreme Court soon. This is according to an AP story from earlier in the week. She said there could be an opening on the Supreme Court soon, but she didn't hint at who might be leaving. Now, Ginsburg spoke this past week at New England Law's annual Law Day. That's New England Law. That must be a school. Having barely made it out of high school myself, ladies and gentlemen, I'm often not familiar with college lingo. But New England Law, I'm assuming, is a law school. And they have an annual Law Day where Justice Ginsburg spoke. Now, that is not to be confused with Judgment Day, where Justice Ginsburg will not have a whole lot to say. Trust me. She will be quite silent. In fact, what is the line from the Bible? Every mouth shall be still, and every knee shall bow. Well, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, here at Law Day, over there at New England Law, she got to spout off and say just about whatever she wanted and impress everyone with her earthly brilliance. But on Judgment Day, Ruth Bader Ginsburg's mouth will be still, and her knee will bow. Now, she's not going to want to bow her knee, but there's going to be a judge there, and there's going to be his bailiffs who are going to be there. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg will bow her knee, whether she wants to or not. And next to seeing a North Korean missile get shot down, that's about the most exciting and fun thing I can imagine, is watching Ruth Bader Ginsburg's bony old knee, bow on Judgment Day. I'm looking forward to that. Now, back to the story. Ginsburg was part of a question and answer session. Let's see here. She said the nine justices only take pictures together when a new member is added. And she said, "We haven't had any of those for some time, but surely we will soon." She declined to take questions from reporters at the event to try to clarify what she was talking about. But you'll remember, ladies and gentlemen, that the 75-year-old Ruth Bader Ginsburg had surgery last month for pancreatic cancer, but sadly returned to the bench without missing a day of work. She says that advice from fellow cancer survivor Sandra Day O'Connor on when to schedule chemotherapy has helped her to keep up with the court's pace. Well, thanks a lot, Sandra Day O'Connor. Now, wasn't she supposed to be a conservative female appointed to the bench by conservative Ronald Reagan? And here she is helping Sandra, Ruth Bader Ginsburg schedule her chemo so she can make it to work and continue to destroy the Republic. Thanks a lot, Sandra Day. I tell you what. All right. Now, that was fairly depressing because now we have to think about the fact that Ruth Bader Ginsburg hasn't missed a day of work, number one. That's terrifying. And that she has no plans of going anywhere. She plans to continue to work. So to pick up your spirits just a little bit, ladies and gentlemen, Dateline Huntsville, Texas. A Fort Worth man convicted of gunning down his ex-girlfriend and her friend was executed this past week as his mother begged him not to die. Well, that's an interesting first line. Anyway, a Dateline Huntsville, Texas often lifts the spirits of the Weekly Worldview audience. Now, we certainly do not revel or celebrate or have any joy in the fact that a murder has occurred. But when we see justice finally doled out justly to a man who's a killer and we see him executed, we celebrate the fact that there is justice in the universe and that even in a worthless, random, mindless justice system, sometimes justice is doled out. James Edward Martinez was injected with soft, mushy, cushy, lethal drugs and sailed off into a Grateful Dead haze-like purple fog there into death. He was condemned for the fatal shootings of Sandra Walton and her 19-year-old friend Michael Humphreys outside her Fort Worth apartment back in the year 2000. 2000. Let's see now. That means he was only on death row for 9 years or less. Well, that's half of what the normal inmate spends on death row. This guy must not have had any money. He must have been broke. And for some reason, the hippie liberals at the ACLU lost interest in his case. I don't know what happened here. How this guy was executed in only 9 years is bizarre because usually it takes a generation or more to kill one of these bastards. Martinez was the 11th condemned inmate to receive the kinder, gentler lethal injection this year in the nation's most active death penalty state and the first of two that were scheduled to die on consecutive nights this past week. And I've got to tell you, folks, I searched the wires. I tried to find it, but I simply could not find the second execution. And that's kind of depressing because that means that yet another murderer somehow has escaped justice, at least for the moment. But as I referred to earlier in relation to Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, there is a judgment day coming, ladies and gentlemen, and I hope you're prepared for it. Now, speaking of judgment day, and I'm not sure how I make this segue, but I'm going to try. Dateline Boston, Massachusetts. This is a story that relates to the stimulus package. And if ever judgment was required, it's going to be required for these people who wrote this stimulus theft package, stealing billions of dollars from you and I and our children and possibly our grandchildren. Let me tell you what's happening with the money. Dateline Boston, more than one out of every $5 of the $126 million Massachusetts is receiving in earmarks from the stimulus package is going to help preserve the legacy of the Kennedys. That's right, I said the Kennedys. Listen to this. The bill included almost $6 million for the planning and design of a building to house a new Edward M. Kennedy Institute for the Senate. An Edward M. Kennedy Institute for the Senate. Now, I'm certain that a number of senators indeed require institutionalization. I'm not going to argue with that. And if ever there was a name that would be appropriate for mad, insane, murderous, thieving senators, it would be called the Edward M. Kennedy Institute. Don't get me wrong. And of course, it would be built in Chappaquiddick in Massachusetts. But I don't think that's what they're talking about here. I think they're actually talking about a building that somehow honors Edward M. Kennedy. You remember Edward M. Kennedy, that guy who killed that girl, who drove that girl off that bridge and then left her there to die. That's how he'll forever be remembered. The bill also includes $22 million to expand facilities at the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and Museum, $5 billion for a new gateway to the Boston Harbor Island on the Rose Kennedy Greenway Park, a park system in downtown Boston named after the matriarch of the Kennedy clan. And I think somewhere in there was at least $1 million or $2 or $3 for the Edward M. Kennedy Memorial VD Clinic. It's the Weekly Worldview, and I'm Doug McBurney, and I am just glad to be back. Now, I want to get to the story I want to go to Bin Laden, but first, we've got to talk about, the coming evangelical collapse. Okay, now this is a story that I believe I pulled off of WorldNet Daily, a fantastic website, if you're interested in news from a right-wing perspective. In fact, news from a right perspective. That's what Joe Farah gives you an opportunity to see at WorldNet Daily. I encourage you all to go there, to bookmark it, and to support their sponsors, because that's what I do every week. This is out of Oneida, Kentucky, written by Michael Spencer. We're on the verge, he says, within 10 years of a major collapse of evangelical Christianity. This breakdown will follow the deterioration of the mainline Protestant world, and it will fundamentally alter the religious and cultural environment in the West. Within two generations, he says, evangelicalism will be a house deserted, and a house deserted of half its occupants. In the Protestant 20th century, evangelicals flourished, he says, but they will soon be living in a very secular and religiously antagonistic 21st century. This collapse will herald the arrival of an anti-Christian chapter of the post-Christian West. Intolerance of Christianity will rise to levels many of us have not believed possible in our lifetimes, and public policy will become hostile toward evangelical Christianity, seeing it as the opponent of the common good. Now, whose fault is this? Well, mainly, it's the evangelicals, because they're a bunch of compromising chumps who for so long have compromised on right and wrong and fundamental issues of life, death, truth, and Christian faith that they simply don't know what is right and what is wrong anymore. And once the foundation turns to sand, the entire building will eventually slide off into the sewer. And that's what's happening to the modern evangelical church. Mr. Spencer, he says, why is this going to happen? And I just posited my view as to why, but let's see what Mr. Spencer has to say. He says, number one, evangelicals have identified their movement with the culture war and with political conservatism. This will prove to be a very, very costly mistake. Now, wait a minute. I disagree with Mr. Spencer slightly here. We have identified our movement, we Christians, I guess I can't count myself among the evangelicals. Now, he talks about they've identified their movement with political conservatism, and you could scratch that out and write in republicanism. Republicanism. And that's what that the evangelicals have thrown in with the Republicans for my entire adult life. Even when the Republicans have become socialists, murderers, and thieves, the evangelicals have seemed to turn a blind eye and have just thrown in with the Republicans, the Republicans, and that's going to be a big mistake. I agree with that. But to say that identifying our movement with the culture war is going to lead to our destruction, I think that had Christians identified their movement with the culture war and really stood up for the issues in the culture war that resonate with not only believers, but people who are looking for something to believe in, the evangelical movement wouldn't be on the verge of collapsing into the sewage system of the Western world. I think we've failed not only to identify the issues in the culture war, but to stand up in an uncompromising way as a church, as a body, and to fight the culture war. That's where the evangelicals have failed. Now, let's see, number two, we're going to go through Mr. Spencer's reasoning here as to why evangelicals are collapsing. He says, we evangelicals, okay, Mr. Spencer apparently is an evangelical, which is interesting to know. He says, we evangelicals have failed to pass on to our young people an orthodox form of faith that can take root and survive the secular onslaught. Bravo, Mr. Spencer. Thank you for pointing out the obvious. You folks in the audience who continue to send your children into the public school factories, not only have you failed to pass on your faith to your children, but you've, through ignorance or selfishness or whatever it is that motivates you to send your kids to the public school, you've undermined not only their faith, but their entire lives. You may be costing your children your life. If you are a Christian and you are sending your child to a public school, you are sinning. If you are a heathen or an atheist and you are sending your child to a public school, you are sinning. And of course, you don't identify sin because you don't believe in all that, but you're doing something very bad. You're doing something harmful to your child. Stop and think about it. Get your kids out of the public schools. There's no way that they can survive the secular onslaught of the public schools, let alone MTV and whatever it is they download on their iPods these days. That in and of itself is destructive and difficult to protect our children from. But to send them for 6 to 8 hours a day into an environment that actively preaches a godless, secular view of life and the world, it's a sin against your children. It's a sin against God. And on Judgment Day, when you're watching Ruth Bader Ginsburg's bony knees go to the ground, you're going to be shaking in your shoes to know that God is going to ask you when you get up there, what were you thinking about sending your kids to the public schools? All right. Now, number three, Mr. Spencer says there are three kinds of evangelical churches today: consumer-driven megachurches, dying churches, and new churches whose future is fragile. Denominations will shrink and even vanish, while fewer and fewer evangelical churches will survive and thrive. Well, duh. Okay, that's what's happening. Number four, despite some very successful developments in the past 25 years, Christian education has not produced a product that can withstand the rising tide of secularism. I would point you to homeschooling, Mr. Spencer, and I would point you to fundamentalist Christians who will survive. Number five, he says, the confrontation between cultural secularism and the faith at the core of evangelical efforts to do good is rapidly approaching. We will soon see that the good evangelicals want to do will be viewed as bad by so many, and much of that work will not be done. Look for ministries to take on a less and less distinctively Christian face in order to survive. And what's the point of surviving? What's the point in surviving if you take on a less and less distinctively Christian face? I mean, that's basically like you start out as a conservative and you end up as a Republican. Sure, you've survived, but what good are you? Number six in the reasons why evangelicalism is collapsing: even in areas where evangelicals imagine themselves strong, like the Bible Belt, we will find a great inability to pass on to our children a vital evangelical confidence in the Bible and the importance of the faith. You know, one thing I've noticed about evangelicals is that I've been to several of these mega churches and what quote-unquote evangelical churches. I mean, you can't spot a Bible in the building. And you certainly can't find a person who understands the Bible. They're all scared of the Bible. Every time someone brings up a Bible verse, they're embarrassed. And you know why? It's because they don't understand the Bible. Why don't they understand the Bible? Well, because they don't know its author. And they choose to live in ignorance and fear instead of getting to know the author and getting to know his word and then taking it up like a sword. Let's see here. Which at Denver Bible Church, by the way, you can't swing your arms in either direction without hitting somebody who has a Bible in their hands and who's not afraid of it and who's not ashamed of it. So come on down and visit us. From anywhere in the world, we'll welcome you for at least one visit. And then we'll decide if we want to let you hang around. But you're welcome to come and visit. All right, you know what? I'm not going to go through any more of his reasons because I'm running out of time. He says, near the end of his article, a small band will work hard to rescue the movement from its demise through theological renewal. And amen. Let's hope for some theological renewal. Let's hope for Bible teachers who don't compromise, who tell people what is right and what is wrong, who teach people how to understand their Bibles, and who can theologically and spiritually renew the church. It can happen, ladies and gentlemen, let's pray that it does. He says aggressively evangelical. I have a problem with the word evangelical, apparently. Aggressively evangelistic fundamentalist churches will begin to disappear. And now that, I consider the church where I attend, Denver Bible Church, to be a fundamentalist church. And we're evangelical to a point. I mean, we just don't let anybody hang out at the church all the time. I mean, we don't allow people who are shacking up or homos just unrepentant sinners. We don't evangelize to the point where we let them hang around the church and corrupt our adults and our children. But he says they'll begin to disappear. And I don't know that I can argue with that point. I'll have to ponder that a little bit more. He ends the story by saying evangelicalism doesn't need a bailout. Much of it needs a funeral. Much of it needs a funeral, he says. It is a good thing that denominations are going to become... I'm sorry, he asked the question, is it a good thing that denominations are going to become largely irrelevant? Only if the networks that replace them are able to marshal resources, training, and vision to the mission fields and into planting and equipping of churches. Well, and you know, this theory kind of matches my theory on the whole government bailout. Everybody's worried about these huge banks and these huge auto companies going bankrupt as if they're going to disappear and vanish and there's going to be nothing left and that everyone's going to end up like 1935 standing in a bread line. Well, I believe that if these large car companies and these large banks were allowed to collapse, that there would be some pain. Some people would end up in a breadline for a little while, but eventually the infrastructure's still there. It simply would need to be infused with new people, with new ideas, with better morals, better ethics, better judgment, and General Motors would rise again. Chrysler would rise again. AIG would rise again. Citibank would rise again. And folks, the evangelical church, let the bloated, phony infrastructure collapse because there are young people who understand the truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ who will come in and who will resurrect what is the true church of Jesus Christ. We're coming to the end of it here, ladies and gentlemen. The debut broadcast here at theweeklyworldview.com. I'm your host, Doug McBurney, and we've just covered the demise of evangelicalism, and let's move on to something else in the same vein. This week, according to Reuters, Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden released another audio tape, and he accused moderate Arab leaders of plotting with the West against Muslims, and urged his followers to prepare for jihad, the holy war, in a recording, an audio recording, aired, interestingly enough, by Al Jazeera Television. Now, I've got to tell you, folks, way back in late 2001, around December, on one of my broadcasts, and we're going to dig it up in the archives, I posited the idea that I believed Osama bin Laden was deader than Elvis. I'm not sure if I put it that way, but I figured the guy was dead when the videos stopped coming, and all we got were some grainy audio tapes. But over the past, let's see, how many years has it been now that we've been fighting this war on quote-unquote terror? It's been since 2001, that would make it, well, coming up on 8 years. And over that 8 years, I have somewhat retracted the idea that Osama bin Laden was dead, because everybody in the intelligence community seemed to think he was alive. And these grainy audio recordings keep coming out that seem to indicate he's alive. And just this week, according to Reuters, Al Jazeera broadcast excerpts from an audio recording in which the speaker's voice sounded like earlier messages from bin Laden. And they tell us that more than 60 messages have been broadcast by bin Laden, his second-in-command, Ayman al-Zawahiri, and their allies since the September 11th attacks. So 60 messages have been broadcast, all grainy audio from Mr. bin Laden himself. And when I saw this story, it brought to mind an article that I read in this month's American Spectator magazine. The magazine dated March 2009. Folks, if you don't get the American Spectator magazine, you are missing out on a tremendous source of information and entertainment and, might I say, great writing. If you like great writing, if you like reading great writers, go to spectator.org, and subscribe to this magazine. You will not be displeased. Let's go to an article from Angelo Codevilla. And it is, the story is entitled Osama bin Elvis, and it says, 7 years after Osama bin Laden's last verifiable appearance among the living, there is more evidence for Elvis's presence among us than for that of Osama bin Laden. That's right. Angelo Codevilla, in the pages of the American Spectator, says that Osama is deader than Elvis, all right? Now, he backs this up, ladies and gentlemen. I know a lot of people, you might think this is crazy to assume that Osama is long dead, but listen to Mr. Codevilla's logic. He says, since this October 2001, when Al Jazeera's Taysir Alooney interviewed him, no reputable person reports having seen him. The audio and videotapes alleged to be Osama's never convinced impartial observers. And in 2007, Switzerland's Daimoe Institute for Artificial Intelligence compared the voices on 15 undisputed recordings of Osama bin Laden with the voices on 15 subsequent ones attributed to Osama. All differed clearly from one another, as well as from the genuine recordings. By contrast, the CIA found all the recordings to be authentic. Now, why, one might ask oneself, would the CIA insist that these audio recordings are indeed Osama bin Laden if there are credible experts who dispute that? What would cause the CIA to want to hang on to the idea that Osama bin Laden is still alive? Well, I'm not going to have time to get into the whole article. I strongly suggest you sign up and receive the American Spectator. But I will read a little bit more from Mr. Codevilla. Angelo Codevilla, great writer, just fantastic. Why would the CIA, he says, but why such gymnastics in the face of Osama's incontrovertible irrelevance? Because Mr. Codevilla makes the point that even if Osama bin Laden is alive, he is completely irrelevant. But why does the CIA insist that not only is he alive, but that he's somehow controlling a network of global Islamic terrorists? He says, Mr. Codevilla tells us, he gives us the key. Because focusing on Osama and Al-Qaeda affirms a CIA axiom dating from the Cold War. Terrorism is the work of rogue individuals and groups that operate despite state authority. This axiom is dear to many in the U.S. government because it leads logically to working with the countries whence terrorists come rather than treating those countries as enemies. It's a lack of courage, ladies and gentlemen, on the part of our own government, of our own beloved nation of America. It's a lack of courage in facing up to the fact that it is states that sponsor terrorism. It is states that make terrorism happen. We'll go back to one more excerpt from Mr. Codevilla's article. What if, in the real world, infiltrators from the intelligence services, the professionals, use the amateur terrorists rather than the other way around? What is the logical consequence of noting the fact that the terrorist groups that make a difference on planet Earth, such as Hamas, Hezbollah, the PLO, Colombia's FARC, are all extensions, respectively, of Iran, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Venezuela? It is the negation of the U.S. government's favorite axiom. It means that when George Bush spoke and when Barack Obama speaks of America being, quote, at war against, quote, extremism or extremists, they are either being stupid or acting stupid. Wow. Hard-hitting stuff. So don't be looking for Osama bin Laden to be captured anytime soon in the tribal regions of Afghanistan or anywhere else, ladies and gentlemen, because the guy is gone, okay? And not, he's dead, all right? He's dead. I'm going to say it. I think he's dead, and he's also irrelevant. And I think that we need to start holding the countries that harbor, sponsor, arm, and equip terrorists, we need to hold those countries responsible and stop being afraid. This war does not need to go on for 50 years. This war can be won. Certain nations must be punished and toppled. All right. Now, let's move on. Do we want to come? Are we that close to out of time? You hear the music coming, ladies and gentlemen? It's amazing how fast the hour goes. It's just stunning. Dateline Silver Springs, Maryland, from the Associated Press. Montgomery police say 16 people were arrested after a fight broke out during a concert held to promote nonviolence. The Free Stop the Violence youth concert was held in downtown Silver Spring, Maryland, in memory of a 14-year-old high school student who was shot to death back in November. Police say fighting broke out near the stage toward the end of the concert, and at least one person resisted arrest. 16 adults and juveniles were arrested for offenses such as assault and disorderly conduct at the nonviolence concert. All right, let's see now. I wanted to get to the article about... here we go. Dateline Wellington, New Zealand. It'll be Barry Manilow versus the Mall Rats. The New Zealand city of Christchurch hopes that putting smooth and gentle tones, the smooth and gentle tones of Barry Manilow into the mix of music to be broadcast through the Central Mall District can pacify unruly teens who congregate there. So they're going to start playing Barry Manilow at the mall to try to get the rotten kids, the Mall Rats, who are there abusing people and spraying graffiti and doing all other kinds of things, try to get them out of the mall. Well, a group of several dozen young people regularly spread rubbish, spray graffiti, get intoxicated, use drugs, swear, and intimidate patrons at the outdoor mall. The city council, police, and local property owners agree that nice, easy-listening music like Manilow's Can't Smile Without You, Mandy, and other hits might change the behavior of the loitering teens. But one 16-year-old told the press newspaper that unfashionable music will not deter us. We would just bring a stereo and play it louder, said Emma Belcher. That's a girl. Folks, what's a liberal to do? I mean, they're insulting Barry Manilow by insisting that his music could possibly help these kids to just be better or at least go away. When what these kids need is a good sound caning, ladies and gentlemen. And then, of course, to be preached the gospel, taught right and wrong, just like so many other kids all around the world. Okay, folks, that's it for the Worldview this week. I will be back next week. Until then, I want to thank the folks at Denver Bible Church. I want to thank the folks at KGOV. That's KGOV.com. Go check it out. I want to thank the folks at Personhood USA. I want to thank my very attractive audio engineer. And I want to thank my other brother, Daryl, for help setting up the Weekly Worldview Studios and keeping the show on track. I'll be back with you next week. Until then, grace be to you and peace be upon you, my brethren.